I'm Carrie Fountain, and this is Just to Say.
Poetry springs forth from authentic human voice.
Poetry is about anarchy. It's about mystery. It's about dreams. It's about, you know, the unknown.
Writing is a way of saying that you and the world have a chance.
This is Carmen Jimenez-Smith, and I'll be reading Migraine Code Switch. Títere, títere título, títere sans título, the tring, tring, tring of Tylenol con la codeine, tattered tripas and tripping balls on pain. Títere in situ, in extremis. Tres turnos chiflados, the thrum of cartoons burned in loops of my tender once upon era. Opening a drawer, grating torrents of fracaso, mamas in bed otra vez. Vete, because even breath is vampiro. Títere en la torre, the queen doblada, trundled in the territory, held up by electric claws in the reptilian brain as an oferta to time's scythe. The angels dig for my teeth in the sand, then fill my head with the amniotic sea.
Oh, thank you. You read that wonderfully. That's great. So, as someone who in now, you know, my childbearing years started suffering very badly from migraines myself, do you have migraines? Is that where this comes from, I imagine?
Yeah. So I don't. So it was interesting. I started getting them when I was pregnant with my first child. Mm-hmm. And I got them sporadically. But then a few years ago, I had almost a year when I was getting them almost every day, or I was getting, you know, these 3-day or 4-day totally debilitating migraines. And it just kind of consumed my life. And I was imagining it, you know, trying to, like, you know, being an artist and thinking like, well, what can I do with this? And I was thinking about it as kind of an altered consciousness and imagining what it was to occupy that space. And they just kind of went away. You know, it was a year, and maybe it was longer than a year. It felt like forever, mm-hmm. of me sort of walking around in this, you know, stupor, and sometimes, you know, having weird hallucinations or ending up in the hospital. So it was very, very consuming experience. And like I said, it went away. And so this poem, I wrote it at a Canto Mundo retreat a few years ago for Latinx poets. I guess being in that space and thinking about the idea of code switching, which I really hadn't done in my poetry, that's how the poem came about, thinking retrospectively about the migraine as a condition. And also, I guess, thinking about how my brain was just sort of disturbed. And, you know, there were these currents. And so these currents could be kind of linguistic currents, because one time I had one of those, I guess they're called complex migraines, where I was babbling, you know, nonsensically. And so there's just this kind. And then sometimes there were like 2 days after a migraine when I couldn't talk or I had a lot of trouble expressing myself. And so it made me think a lot about where my language was coming from and how I expressed it. And the occasion of Canto Mundo allowed me to both think about the migraine and also think about my Latinx identity in my work as a poet.
So you're saying that your migraines went away?
I still get them, but
the
almost daily migraine
experience, yeah,
you know, problem kind of. I suspect retrospectively that it was stress, but it sort of vanished as quickly as it appeared. And, you know, I had these feelings of like ghost migraines. I thought, oh my God, it's happening again, and it wouldn't be happening again. And I changed my diet. I did all sorts of different things. It was this mysterious period in my life, and it made me think a lot about it. You know, and I read about people who were migraineurs.
I love that word.
Yeah, I know. I love it too. It sounds very fancy.
Yes. I
think Joan Didion wrote an essay about it.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I find so interesting about migraines, and I love the idea also that you have written this poem almost like in retrospect, like about a time. that has passed, because migraines are, they're absolutely like disorienting, right? Like,
yes.
And they place you in the moment in a way that's kind of horrible, but truly in the moment. And I always feel the thing that I am most self-conscious about when I feel a migraine coming on, and the thing that, you know, some people think, oh my gosh, I'm going to get a migraine, I can't drive my car, or I can't, you know, I'm not going to be able to see in about a half an hour, I'm going to need to lay down. My thing is that I totally lose the ability to put words in front of each other and make coherent sentences. And it's so self-conscious. Like I get so self-conscious about it. I would have to cancel something if I had to do something publicly, if I had a migraine, not because I couldn't like experience the pain in public. It's just that I find myself, it's terrifying in a way to not have that faculty. And the other thing that I find really interesting personally about this poem and the code switching and the, I'm not sure if is it was English your first language or Spanish your first language?
Spanish was my first language.
So what's also very interesting to me is, and I know that you have some poems in the collection about dementia, your mother's dementia, is that right?
Yes.
So
yes.
When my grandfather was elderly and suffering from dementia, he, surprisingly, toward the end of his life, stopped speaking English and went back to his first language. I thought that was, it was a surprise to us too, because none of our, the grandchildren didn't ever experience him as speaking Spanish. It was disorienting. So there's something like in that to me too about the primal space that you enter when you are in that kind of experience of a migraine, and, you know, you just sort of perhaps lose your, you lose the ability to, you know, speak the language that you want to speak, and you sort of, or you know, that you or that you feel is appropriate to speak, and you just go kind of back to like sounds or your first language or whatever. I just thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, I think my mom also doesn't speak English anymore. She has Alzheimer's and so she has gone back to Spanish in a lot of ways, and I guess sort of, and she's in Peru. She's in a nursing home in Peru. So returning to that identity, you know, her pre-American or her pre-U.S. identity, I totally agree. Like, you become this kind of base consciousness. And I remember one time going in to teach, because I didn't have a choice. I couldn't, you know, it was getting to the point where I was missing class all the time, and I couldn't do it anymore. And so I was talking, and it was just kind of like, I felt like I was literally in my head finding the words and putting them together, and I could hear myself talking. And it was just, there was such an effort involved in constructing thought. I mean, even though I had access to what, in a way, like in an ephemeral way, I knew that I had the thought, it was making the thought language. And that was really, really interesting in terms of thinking about first, you know, the experience of migraine, but also what it must be to, you know, the aphasia connected to dementia.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so, you know, there was this kind of simultaneous awareness of, you know, of like just your brain being messed up for, you know, for different reasons.
Right. And how disorienting it is, but also it's, you know, one of the things about migraine too that is, I think, and I think it seems like you experienced it in the same way. When I was pregnant with, I sort of had migraines and they would come, and it gave me an appreciation for people who had serious migraines, but it wasn't a life-hindering thing for me. And then during my second pregnancy, I did start having the, like, for the first time, the 3-4-day-long migraines. My experience, up until that point, I could go to bed and wake up in the morning and it would be gone. And that feeling is just so terrifying. Like, I really could start understanding, like, people in chronic pain, just like, I couldn't take the medicine, but the medicine wouldn't have worked anyway. Like, there's just a point where you just go, like, what is the future going to be? It's terrifying, but it's also just like, I totally understand why this is just untenable for people. Like, it really is. It is not a small thing. It is a really, it is a really debilitating experience.
And I guess, you know, as you know, like, there's this kind of Latinx, like, you know, you could be bleeding and you go to work. You know, like mm-hmm. you could have mm-hmm. a knife wound and you go to work.
Mm-hmm.
And there was something about like being unable to do that, what the migraine did was it didn't give me a choice. Mm-hmm. I had to rest. I had to stop. I had to halt my life. And that was interesting as someone who's kind of a workaholic,
mm-hmm.
It didn't give me the choice. I didn't have the option like going in with the flu or even being able to work on my computer while I was in bed. It was like, you're done. There's nothing you can do. You got to just be still.
Mm-hmm.
And that was weird for me too.
Yeah. And in a way it does make you tremendously aware of your own need for self-care in a way.
Yeah.
You know? Just to, I mean, talk a little bit about you and your experience and what brought you to poetry in the first place? To write poetry, I mean.
I mean,
it was reading poetry, but what drew you? What are your first experiences?
So I recently was thinking about the fact that this book is being published on City Lights and mm-hmm. in high school, I had a teacher at Santa Teresa High School named Nathan Sheehy, and he was born in San Francisco. He lived in San Francisco, and he had been in proximity with the Beats.
Mm.
And he talked about that, and he talked about, you know, the whole scene and Lawrence Ferlinghetti and, you know, Gregory Corso and all of the players. And so I became aware of that, but also he taught me how to do a he taught the class how to do a close reading of poetry. And so once I kind of learned that and that skill was, you know, definitely deepened in college for me. But that original moment of like reading a poem and seeing kind of like how it works as a puzzle, in the sense of like an image system and collecting it, there was something very, very satisfying to me about experiencing that. And, you know, when I was in high school, I thought I'm going to be an English teacher because I worshipped my English teachers.
Mm.
But when I went to college, and actually when I went to college, I wanted to be a short story writer. I wanted to write prose. But it, you know, it just happened that I was better at poetry. Like, you know, my stories just, there nothing happened. You know, it was very hard for me to create tension and to write scene. I felt like scene felt like so plotting and like it felt kind of uncomfortable. I did write stories, and sometimes I look back and I can't believe that I wrote stories because I don't think I could write a story now to save my life. But I did love so much trying to render the ineffable into language and reaching into myself and seeing the things that I didn't have language for, or also imagining, you know, and this is kind of a recurrent theme in my work, you know, ideas, sort of concepts or ideas that I got from my mother and also rendering them in work, or my history, and thinking about, you know, making the idea of being Latinx or, you know, in the 90s, Hispanic, something that was seen.
Mm-hmm.
And I had really fantastic teachers in college, and I went to San Jose State, and I worked for the Center for Literary Arts there, and there was, a terrific reading series. And so I also just had a kind of contact with authors and writers. You know, I'd pick them up from airports, and I would take them to lunch, and I would go to every reading and every talk. And so I just received this kind of schooling from amazing people. And I just was still super attracted to the craft. I was a voracious reader. I still am a voracious reader. And for me, I just, in a way, it was like learning how to dance. And I just was also really compelled by seeing someone do something in a poem and then wanting to do it myself.
Mm-hmm.
But it really started with this teacher in high school. And so the fact that, you know, when he was talking about City Lights, you know, there I was, a 16-year-old, and saying, someday I want to be published by City Lights, mm-hmm. you know, because I was this, you know, this young woman in the Bay who had lived in the Bay Area.
for most of my teens, and you know, and I went to college there, and so that desire never went away. And the fact that this book is on City Lights is still completely stunning to me. There's a way in which I can't believe it, because it has been a dream for so long.
And it's like everyone's dream. Everyone who has a history, and I mean, right? City Lights is like the iconic, like, birthplace of the almost like the poetry movement. You know, it's like it's not
yes.
like. That's awesome. That's great.
Yeah.
I'm so happy for you. My father and
Thank
mother
you.
Actually met in San Francisco. My father is from Mesilla and went away for 1 year to be like a hippie. And in 1969, they lived in the Haight. And he met my mom, who was from New York City, and then took her back to Mesilla. You are someone who will truly appreciate that, since
yes.
you lived in that place for so long. And there wasn't even paved roads when my mom got there. But
sure.
he has a story. Like, one of his favorite stories is walking by City Lights and looking at a poster in the window. I can't remember what the poster was of. Sort of like dreaming and looking at it, and Lawrence Ferlinghetti like came to the window, and like, you know, they made some like signal to each other, and he took the poster down and like brought it outside. The bookstore wasn't open at that time, and he like brought it outside and gave it to my dad. My dad was like blown away.
Wow.
I know, isn't that so cool?
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Does he still have the poster?
I'm sure he does. He has everything. I mean,
right.
he has everything. It's probably somewhere in El Patio. Like, just like not, like with no reference, like no context. It's like hanging next to like a beer poster.
Right.
Do you feel like you were influenced by the Beats?
I was. You know, for me, there was a way in which I was, but for me, I was always attracted to image and a kind of deep image and, you know, tactile. You know, something that felt meaty, and you know, so I was such a huge Sylvia Plath person. I was a huge James Wright person, but and I guess the other thing I was attracted to was a vernacular kind of poetry. Though, you know, when you're first writing poetry, even if you are a reader, you do this kind of stilted tone, and I couldn't imagine myself doing that kind of, you know, hip, loose talk. I was always a little, I wanted to be this kind of lyric poet that was, you know, tight, tight, tight. And you know, I think over the years, as I've looked at my collections retrospectively, and then the occasion of working on this book, which I had a sort of a set of poems. And I realized, like, this is a City Lights book. So, and it's a tiny book, right? Like, the shape of it is tiny. So I had to write sort of shorter poems. I go on and on and on sometimes in poems. But then I also wanted to capture, like, the spirit of that poetry. And revisiting it, I did realize, like, oh, this was, you know, kind of implicitly a big influence in my work, because Allen Ginsberg was very meaty. I don't know. I mean, it was an influence also in just the sense of like the idea of San Francisco. And I remember when I was in high school, my friend Mike and I, and we were obsessed with the 60s and 70s, and we would listen to The Doors and, like, you know, read this poetry and read Jack Kerouac, and just, you know, we wanted to have that kind of urbane energy. And we would go to San Francisco and just sort of be dazzled and go to like the communist bookstores. And so it was more of it was just kind of a sense of like what the city was. And, you know, it's not that anymore. The city isn't what it was in the 90s. Like, it's become this kind of gentrified mm-hmm. corporate kind of space. I mean, it still has its little pockets of wildness, but it's too expensive for it to be what it was, that kind of wild energy. But we were both hungry for that, and we sought it out. And so it was less a matter of, being attracted to an aesthetic, though. Like, I loved Diane de Prima. I loved Amiri Baraka. I loved thinking about the tradition of the small press and the small magazine. And, you know, I've always in some way or another been involved in some kind of editorial venture. And so that kind of stuff was really – resonant for me. But there was also a kind of masculinity that I didn't feel part of in a lot of the work.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes that was kind of a turnoff for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you think about all the women who were writing at that time who just didn't have the, the publication. They just were, I'm sure, you know, it's like Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, you know.
Exactly.
I know that I asked you to bring in a poem to sort of read to us. I am constantly interested in hearing what a poet's favorite poem is, or like, you know, not a favorite poem, but just like which, if you had the chance to read a poem to the world, what would it be?
Yes.
So what poem did you bring in? Will you read it first? And then we'll talk about it?
Okay. This is a poem called Personals by C.D. Wright. Personals. Some nights I sleep with my dress on. My teeth are small and even. I don't get headaches. Since 1971 or before, I have hunted a bench where I could eat my pimento cheese in peace. If this were Tennessee and across that river, Arkansas, I'd meet you in West Memphis tonight. We could have a big time. Danger, shoulder soft. Do not lie or lean on me. I am still trying to find a job for which a simple machine isn't better suited. I've seen people die of money. Look at Admiral Benbow. I wish, like certain fishes, we came equipped with light organs, which reminds me of a little-known fact. If we were going the speed of light, this dome would be shrinking while we were gaining weight. Isn't the road crooked and steep? In this humidity, I make repairs by night. I'm not one among millions who saw Monroe's face in the moon. I go blank looking at that face. If I could afford it, I'd live in hotels. I won awards in spelling in the Australian crawl. Long, long ago, grandmother married a man named Ivan. The men called him Eve. Stranger, to tell the truth, in dog years, I am up there. So that poem was written by C.D. Wright. It's in a very early collection of hers called String Light, which I bought when I was in graduate school. It was actually published in 1991.
I love that poem. I've never read that poem before.
Yes.
I've seen people die of money.
I know.
Just a great line. I mean, just so many great lines. That poem reminds me a lot of the poems in your book. I also remember now what I was thinking of, which was not a question, but just an observation when you're talking about, like, wanting to have that vernacular, you know, the vernacular of the beats, but also wanting to sort of be lyrical and have crafted poems and made poems. That so accurately describes your book that you made, Cruel
Thank
Futures.
You.
It does both of those things, and it does it together. And it's really unique. It's a unique experience reading. I think I told you, like, the best word that I could come up with to describe so many of the poems was the word confident, which seems a little bit, like, simplistic. It started me having this big conversation in my mind because I wanted to say, oh, they're unapologetic. And that's a totally word that people use to describe women's work. And
right.
It implies that an apology is being, that an apology is necessary and it's just not being rendered in a way.
Right.
But I think that's part of it, that there's this confidence of language, but also a very complicated, intellectual, experiential, spiritual thing happening at the same time. And I think that's really wonderful in your poems, and also in the poem that you just read. I mean, that's something that C.D. Wright does so well as well.
This book was so important to me when I was in graduate school. It was like this book that I kept by my side all of the time. Part of it for me was her voice is so unique, and trying to figure out how she did it. And so I would read this book over and over and over and over again. And that poem was always interesting to me because I remember the kind of speaker that I created for each of the poems. in this collection seem to have like different kinds of speakers. There's a kind of, you know, persona energy in the book. And with these kind of oblique, you know, voicey, this, you know, voicey lines, they're just, they're people and they have bodies. And I just like, I was like, how do you do that? So this book, it's out of print. And I realized I'm not going to lend it out anymore because, you know, when you teach, you lose books over the years.
Oh my God,
but this is a book
you?
That I'm just not going to be willing to lose, because this particular book is the one that I had 20 years ago in graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
This is the book that I've probably read the most in my life.
Wow. It's just insane to me that any C.D. Wright book would be out of print. It's just, it's an unfair world.
I know. I see. I recommended it to someone recently, and that's what she told me. So then
it was
I was
out of
like,
print.
Okay, then I'm not.
Then
I'm
you
not
can't lend
it
out. That's how I feel about Adelia Prado's "The Alphabet in the Park." Like, I'll consider lending it to a student or giving it to a student, even. And but I have to check on Amazon to make sure that it's still in print, because I'm not, you know, I'm not going to give away the only possible last copy of that book. I've read it a million times as well. Okay, one second, Carmen. Is there anything else that we needed?
And there's one kind of thing I wanted to ask.
You want to ask her?
I'll just ask.
Hey, Carmen, it's Rebecca McEnroy, the producer of This Is Just to Say.
Just reading this poem and then listening to the poem that you read, that you brought in, there's this overarching theme of machines and people and what makes us human. And I love, like, the reclaiming of the migraine, like writing about the migraine as a reclamation of humanity. And this line in the last poem that you read about, I'm searching for a job that machines can't do, and I've seen people die of money. I heard something today, which was a conversation about automatons and the future of automatons. And the guy said, really, it's not about, are we going to find machines who can do jobs of humans, but can we ever stop treating human beings as if they are machines?
Mm. Right.
And it just made me think about how we define work and humanity. And poetry is one of those spaces where, you know, you have to be a human to create a poem, you know? And so I don't know if those themes of like machines and working and automatons and, you know, this being embodied as a person and what that means through poetry ever come up in your thought process.
Absolutely. So my next collection is called Bee Recorder, and it's going to be published by Grey Wolf in 2019. And the it has a long poem. It's I think it's like 50 pages. And in a sense, that's exactly what it's talking about. I'm imagining immigrant labor and also like the globalization of capitalism and how ruinous it's been and how exploitative it is, and kind of having this futurist apocalyptic or dystopian sense of how much we give over to labor and how it makes us, it causes a lot of problems for our bodies and for our sense of community and our sense of connection. And, you know, it's resisting becoming, the idea is like resisting becoming a machine or a cog, or destroying our bodies in labor, for labor, for capital. So that's absolutely, you know, something that I'm thinking about and something that I critique in my work. And so I'm glad you saw that. because, again, like being the daughter of immigrants, who, you know, my parents always had three jobs or two, you know, they were always working. It wasn't optional. It wasn't like they could say, you know what, I want some time to myself. I want to, you know, whatever. It was, you worked. That's what, if you were awake, you worked. And part of it for them, even though it was a failed attempt at achieving the American dream. And I think the American dream is, you know, an illusion that forces people to work harder, you know, than they have to or than they should. was, you know, I could see there was a kind of futility. And, you know, even though I'm also like, I got acculturated to it, and I do work, and I, you know, I always have more than one job. Even as an academic, I edit a magazine, I edit poetry for The Nation, and I run a small press. I also feel like, why am I doing this? Like, why am I participating so much in the destruction of my own body, and in giving myself over to, to that world, when I could just have myself and my autonomy? And you know, I also have a great deal of privilege. You know, differently than my parents, I have a lot of privilege. And so I guess in a way I'm using my privilege to critique a system that's exploitative, not just in the United States, but also around the world, but particularly in Latin America. And I think that that came from the experience of living in New Mexico, so close to Juarez. And, you know, Carrie, I remember like just driving to El Paso, and on one side you see like, you know, U.S. and on the other side you just see like just this abject poverty, and like the proximity that you're just, that's just separated from with a highway, just highlighted to me just how unjust late capitalism is.
You write so much. I'm so impressed with your output. It is stunning to me.
Well, part of it is I think it's a little bit, honestly, it's obsessive compulsive. I can't just be working on one thing. And so the long poem I've been working on, I don't even know, like I would say 8 years. And it's just kind of accumulated and grown. And I've just kind of been working on it and working on it and working on it. And then just kind of poems have attached to it. And with this book, with the City Lights book, I had a conception of what the book was going to be, and then the election happened, and it was just like a gut punch. And so, like, after I was weeping in my bed for like, you know, a week, I just had this moment where I was like, you have to activate this grief into something else. This grief for the death of, you know, of like already a kind of tenuous democracy. Mm-hmm. And so I used that anxiety and that rage to just write a bunch of poems. And so there's a way in which some of these poems, and this is, I think, the first book that's felt this way. They're poems that are very like new, or that haven't been worked over in this way that I've always worked them over. And there's a poem in the collection called Oakland Float. And I was doing this poem a day thing. And I wrote this poem, and I sent it to my friend Giovanni Singleton, it took her a minute. And in the meanwhile, I was editing it and editing it and editing it. And I wrote her back and I said, look, I have another version of it. And so I sent it to her, and we talked on the phone, and she said, you need to go back to that first version. Like, you've done too much to it. And there was a sense in that moment where I was like, that's a beat impulse, right? Like the beats were so influenced by like the conception of the romantic poet. And so I was like, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. And so like, I, instead of like really curating what I was doing in the poem, I just kind of let myself be loose. And that became a lesson for the poems that I wrote subsequently for this collection. I just was like, this is it. Like, I'm just going to let it go and kind of be this messy thing, which I hadn't ever done before. So in that way, and I, with every book, I want it to be a different kind of book. I don't want to be that poet who writes. I mean, and obviously there are things that I just keep talking about and thinking about, but I wanted it to be a book that was different from everything else that I've done. And so in that way, just kind of having a looser, more relaxed, not super revising, obsessive poem was the energy that I brought to this book.
That's I love that. I mean, it's such an impulse too. Like, it's just, that's a lucky friend. That's lucky to have that friend too, who read the poem and said, "I'm, you know, go back." Because then I would, of course, as my own obsessive compulsive thing would make me go like, "Oh shit, I should have done that for every poem that I've written till now." I can just go back to, writing is. I think that the thing that we've now done, like what this is like our eighth or ninth interview, and almost like so many of the poets that we've talked about have talked about obsessive compulsive disorder, and not in a joking way, you know, like it's just, does seem to be something that we should like survey the poetry community and see. Right. I think we'd find a lot of us out there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it requires being meticulous.
Yes, of course. And obsessive. I mean, right. Like, that's the initial impulse, right? Yeah. In a lot of ways. Okay. It was so nice to talk to you.
It was so nice to talk to you. We should just talk next time, not for a radio show.
I know. It's so nice to hear your voice and say hi to Evan.
I will.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. Take care.
You can find Migraine, Code Switch, and other wonderful poems in Carmen Jimenez-Smith's brand new book, Cruel Futures. This Is Just to Say is produced at KUT Studios in Austin, Texas. I'm Carrie Fountain. Thanks for listening.